760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, Orange County, but LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, down to Cabo. We're free on iTunes. If you search It's Your Money and Your Life, you can hear us there. We stream live on 760KFMB.com, and all the podcasts are at IYMoney.com. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He's an accomplished marathon runner. He's a best-selling author. He is a CPA extraordinaire and a family office expert advising several high net worth families. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you?
I'm marvelous. It's been a fun week, Joe.
Oh, my God. It was a busy. Epic week for us, I would say. Yeah. All on Tuesday. Yeah. Well, here, let's tell everybody what happened because
let's start with the tennis. Because I think the other one's a little bit even
quickly,
better.
Quickly, because we have a VIP.
Yeah, okay, the San Diego Aviators, the local WTT team that's new here, opened up on Monday night, so that was fun.
I was there.
You were there. I was there. And then Tuesday night, Billie Jean King and the Philadelphia Freedoms came into town, and of course she was honored. And they gave her a great surfboard with a picture embossed on it of her winning her last Wimbledon title in 1975. So that was a lot of fun. World Team Tennis is a lot of fun. So people check it out, SanDiegoAviators.com.
Down at the sports arena, and I think they have matches through the month of July, right?
July 20, July 22, July 23 coming up here in terms of here in town. They're on the road.
And, of course, she'll be back here for the WTT Junior Nationals at the Barnes Tennis Center at the end of July.
Yep.
Right, so you get a chance to meet her, and maybe we'll get her back on the show again.
Exactly, but even better than that.
Well, yeah, look, I was working on this event since we had Irwin Jacobs on in January of 2013. When he spilled the beans and said his son Paul, chairman of the board of Qualcomm, was a Trekkie, a Star Trek fan. So I said, someday we're going to show a movie at Qualcomm. And I was debating whether we should use the George Takei documentary, which just came. Then I remembered the son of Gene Roddenberry, and maybe the colonel will talk with him a bit about this if he was a fan. But the son of Gene Roddenberry, Rod Roddenberry, made a documentary in 2012 called Trek Nation. And after several months of planning, I invited Rod down to Qualcomm and somehow was able to maneuver myself into conducting the Q&A on stage. And not only did the chairman of the board of Qualcomm, the Fortune 149 company with 31,000 employees, show up, make the introductions and stay for the whole thing, but also, the founding CEO and his wife, Irwin Jacobs and Joan Jacobs, were there as well. So that was, and you were there, Richard, and boy, it was spectacular, wasn't it?
And about 400 other people. It was amazing how many people turned up.
Well, did they have the questions or what? They was really engaged. But anyway, it's time to introduce.
You said the colonel. Nobody knows who you're talking
about.
Well,
they will. They will.
They'll find out.
They will now. So we better, this is probably one of the bigger guests we've had on the show, I'd have to say. This gentleman here was a former chief of staff to the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. And I believe he worked with him when he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, pretty much the right-hand person to Colin Powell for 16 years. And now he's a professor at a couple of universities. He's been all over the media several times for the past several years. And we're really fortunate to have him on the line. And his name is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. So, Colonel, how are you today?
I'm doing good. It's not raining here yet.
Good.
You're back in where, Falls Church? Or
Virginia.
Virginia. Yeah. Wonderful. Were you a Star Trek fan, by the way, just out of curiosity?
Was I a Star Trek fan?
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I have to admit, and some of my friends who are Trekkies think this is sort of bad. I like Patrick Stewart better than the original.
You know, Rod Roddenberry had the same emotion, and so that's certainly a good opinion to have, I would think. So, yeah, he said he might do a startup. He would go on a starship with Patrick Stewart, but he might just only do a startup company with William Shatner.
That's a good way of putting it.
Too risky. But anyway, and you're recovering well from your knee surgery. How's that going? You sound pretty lucid, so they probably don't have you too
Well, it's been it's been about 2 months now, so the knee is looking pretty good in terms of recovering from the surgical scar and so forth. It's just the stiffness now that I have to get rid of and you know, get back to walking normally again.
So doing all the rehab and all that.
Yeah.
So. Gotcha. But anyway, just a quick thumbnail sketch of your career. I mean, you were born in South Carolina, and then I know you were you served in Vietnam. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about your service there, because I know you there was even some controversy starting in those early years about the way we were conducting ourselves. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that? Or
I was on the campus of Bucknell University in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania at the time. We're talking about 65, 66, and I was a rising senior, as they say today. It was the summer between my junior and senior year, and I was going back to be a senior, and I did two things that summer. I got married, and second, I considered my responsibility for the Vietnam War and said, hey, I'm going to enlist.
Mm-hmm.
My father had served. He had served in World War II, and I'd grown up, you know, with a military uniform on and a little helmet and a little rifle and so forth, and I'd played more military games in the backyard than I had played cops and robbers or cowboys and Indians or other things that kids did during those times.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was my responsibility, so I enlisted, and I enlisted for Airborne Ranger Vietnam.
Wow.
And wound up taking, I enlisted in December of 66, and I wound up taking almost 3 years to get to Vietnam because the Army kept derailing me.
Huh.
Everywhere I'd go, I would say, I want to go to Vietnam. Send me to Vietnam. And they would say, no, we're going to do this with you, and that with you.
Yeah. But, gosh, you know, Vietnam, I heard the current Secretary of Defense state that Iraq was really Vietnam 2.0. This was before he was appointed, of course. But did we learn any lessons? I mean, it seems like we've repeated, you know, some of the mistakes. You know, what did we gain out of Vietnam? All that bloodshed. Now we're pretty much trading partners. It's become a tourist mecca for us now. I mean, it's kind of
we have become a, as I say in my lectures to my students sometimes, we have become a nation, an empire whose raison d'être, reason for being, is to make war. We have been at war more frequently, and in my seminars we document this and sit down and do case studies on each of them. We've been at war more frequently since the end of the Cold War than we were during the Cold War, when we had proxies all over the world doing our business for us.
Mm-hmm.
We've conducted more covert operations. Look around the world today. You'll see covert operations in Caracas trying to bring down first Hugo Chavez and now his successor. You'll see covert operations in Kiev. You'll see covert operations in Damascus. You'll see covert operations all across the globe, now aimed at supposedly counter-terrorist efforts rather than anti-communist efforts. But in essence, they are efforts to preserve the wealth and power of empire, which is what we have become.
Right. And, of course, there's the analogies to Rome and everything else. I mean, it's at some point, you know, the economy factors into this, and we've seemed to have become a huge, you know, debtor nation. And
and yet, if you take a look at this new book by the French economist, which is sort of sweeping across the globe like a tidal wave, Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century, which I think has the potential for an impact across the globe like Karl Marx's original Capital did, and not for nothing did Piketty probably pick his title in that regard.
Well, we have to take a short break, Colonel, but let's revisit that thought when we come back right after this. So sorry about the interruption. We'll be right back. Hang on. All right, we are back with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former right-hand person to Colin Powell for 16 years. And we were talking about Thomas Piketty's book when we left off. So what were you saying there?
You were talking about how we were a debtor nation, and
right.
What he shows very dramatically in that book is we are probably the richest nation in the world, with the European Union being right behind us. The problem is that the government doesn't own any of that wealth. The government is a net wash or even a negative to a certain extent, the wealth is in the hands of the people, but the people aren't the majority of the people. The people in whose hands the wealth resides are the top 1/1000th of the population, to a lesser extent, the top 1%, and to a lesser extent still, the top 10%. When you look at those figures and you begin to understand that 1/1000th of the United States is 311 million people, own 60 to 70% of the national wealth of this country, the richest country in the world, then you begin to understand a little bit more about the problems we have in this country, a little bit more probably about why we're so war-loving, and a little bit more about why there seems to be no way to get anything done politically anymore. Mm-hmm. The oligarchs in this country don't want us to get anything done because, thank you very much, they really like the situation.
Well, it's kind of getting like an aristocracy and a monarchy, and of course we all know what happened to a lot of them, you know.
Yes. Well, that's Piketty's point. Yeah. We're at a point in this country, and he's a very humble guy when he writes. It's astonishing. I don't find that. I don't find humility amongst most economists or academicians in general. But it's almost to the point where we are like pre-revolutionary France, and Europe is not much different. Mm-hmm. Europe is in the same boat in terms of being experiencing a disequilibrium of wealth that is not unlike that which preceded the French Revolution, which is a little bit dangerous, I think.
I think the one difference is, though, we don't see the palaces visibly. I mean, the uber wealthy, the top, you know, the people that you're talking about are very adept at staying, under the radar, at least from a media standpoint. We don't really can't name it. Well, the Koch brothers always come to mind, but, I mean, there's several more out there.
There are quite a few, and you're right. They have learned their lesson, if you will.
But Colonel, can I ask a question going back to Vietnam?
Sure. And
I happen to believe Vietnam would have been a different story had President Kennedy not been assassinated and, you know, Johnson succeeded him. But my question is a philosophical one, and it's this. What degree of skepticism should a president apply to the advice that he's getting from military advisors? I know Kennedy was deeply affected, for example, by the Bay of Pigs experience.
Right. Yes, Kennedy had, I won't say he had a hatred for the Pentagon. I'll use the Pentagon as a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
But after the Bay of Pigs, I think he had been burned badly enough to where he had a real problem with it. And if you study that case closely, you'll understand why. He also had a real problem with the CIA.
Right.
In many respects, the CIA and the military had set him up for the Bay of Pigs, the CIA knowing that it would probably fail, and the military knowing, they thought, that Kennedy would then call upon them to bail him out.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of a collusion between particularly certain members of the Joint Chiefs and Allen Dulles at the CIA. And it went to hell because Kennedy did not perform according to their wishes. After that, he was very leery. He put Maxwell Taylor in because he didn't trust anybody but Max Taylor. Max Taylor then turned out to be one of the biggest problems for the Vietnam conflict.
Mm-hmm.
In the book that really revealed that, Max Taylor is shown as McNamara and others as mm-hmm. actually lying to the president. It's a very troubling time, but it sets the stage for, as you intimated earlier, it sets the stage for not only not learning lessons, but repeating the same mistakes over and over again, whether it's Afghanistan versus Pakistan and the Taliban, or whether it's Iraq, or whether it's the potential for Syria or Iran or Ukraine. We don't seem to learn any lessons. We just seem to keep doing the same things over and over again. The only way you can explain this in a rational way is to see how people profit from these things
mm-hmm.
we do over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bulk of us would probably, I'd say somewhere between 70 and 80% of us, would probably not agree with any of this were we to be able to access what is really happening. And what is really happening is the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And the empire is frittering away its ultimate power, economic and otherwise,
mm-hmm.
on its peripheries. in these endless wars.
Speaking of profiting, I wanted to explore Halliburton a little bit with you because people seem to forget that the Vice President Cheney was the CEO from 95 to 2000 and didn't do a very good job and kind of took them over to the cliff financially. So I'm wondering if that might have influenced any of his bloodlust to get into a war.
I think some of the things that have been said about Dick Cheney with regard to his commercial interests are true, Halliburton being the foremost one of them. But I don't think that was the principal motivation for Dick Cheney. I think Dick Cheney is what one would call a hyper-nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's an amoral person. I don't think he has any ethical code. I think his code is power, pure and simple. And in that respect, I could make some defense of him because his argument that we're a weapon of mass destruction to go off in a major American city, even if the chances of that are only 1% or even less,
mm-hmm.
That would be the end of our republic. Mm-hmm. Therefore, and the end of our republic would then be described to him as the martial law that would have to be declared, the draconian procedures the president would be by necessity having to implement and so forth, would simply destroy our republic. So you want to prevent that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go into this contorted logic of, in order to prevent that, then you can torture, you can take away people's civil liberties, you can wage constant war, you can do all these things because they are the lesser evil.
Not to mention
they are not as bad as the big one you're trying to prevent.
Not to mention the NSA, you know, intercepting every communication by every American.
But look at what's happened. We can say this all about Cheney, and in many respects, what's happening today in some of these more sophisticated areas is worse than what was happening during the Cheney-Bush regime. So you have to ask yourself, what is it about the politics of fear? What is it about the exploitation of the politics of fear that makes presidents believe that they have to do these things? I have, you have, about as much chance, I'm told by experts, of dying from a terrorist attack, statistically speaking, as we do of dying from a lightning strike. And yet we have spent three, by some estimates, four or five, by other estimates, $1 trillion on the so-called war against terror since 2001. And it just seems to me to be as illogical as hell unless you start looking at the people, the entities that are making billions of dollars from this conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And then it becomes a little bit more explicable.
Well, a billion for the war itself, and then, of course, the rehab and the tragic circumstance for a lot of the the amputees, the troops returning home that need lifelong care.
Oh, these wars just keep on costing.
I mean, it's up to I've seen estimates $3 trillion and up to $5 trillion. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I think probably Iraq alone, discounting the larger global war on terror and Afghanistan, Iraq alone was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 trillion.
Wow.
Wow.
We'll get into more of that. We got to take a break right now. Colonel, will be right back with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson after these news, sports, and weather and these remarks. Hang on. All right, we are back with the second half of It's Your Money and Your Life, the award-winning show. Over to Richard to thank our sponsors.
Thank you, sponsors. UBS in downtown La Jolla, Mr. Michael Carranza and Drew Fetus, Mike Carranza and his son Adam, were, of course, at the Qualcomm event, watching Trek Nation on Tuesday night. It was good to see you guys. Right across the street, the best business bank in San Diego, Regents Bank, with Sean Puckett, Steve Sefton, Brenda Geiger at the Geiger Law Offices, specializing in estate planning and asset protection. Soon to be new daddy, well, actually to be a second time around, Jason Kruger, best CFO service in San Diego, Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Paul Polito and Don Epic with Polito Epic CPAs up in Vista. Carl Sheeler with Berkeley Research Group, helping business owners improve the values of their businesses by understanding their risks much, much better than they ever have before. And last but not least, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow, Mr. Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives. Joel and his lovely wife, of course, were out at the Billie Jean King event Tuesday night with me and about 20 other people, and that was a lot of fun. So Joel Grushkin, Cost Segregation Initiatives. Also, Courtney Lauver, who runs our amazing website, iymoney.com, which is where you can do what, Joe?
Well, if you get over to iymoney.com, you can learn all about our sponsors. Get your cursor over to the sponsor drop-down menu and just click on any or all of them, and all their information is there, their phone numbers, emails, every bit of information to get a hold of them. And they've all been working with Richard for many, many years with great success. Right, Richard?
Long, long time. In some cases, almost 25 years. We're not as young as we used to be.
Yes, sir. Hey, back to the colonel, though, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. I know Richard wanted to talk a little bit about 9/11. A lot of people forget what happened on 9/10, though, of 2001. And that's the day that Secretary Rumsfeld got on television and said the Pentagon books were either out of balance or they couldn't keep track of $2 trillion or something like that. Do you recall that happening, Colonel?
I don't recall that amount. I recall him talking about the Pentagon being unable to account for about $40 billion, which I thought at the time was sort of ironic. It was more than state got for an entire year.
Well, I mean, that if you Google that or go on YouTube, there is that statement. And then, of course, 9/11 happened the next day. And Richard had a question about 9/11. What was your question?
Well, my specific question is, in hindsight, was the response that we made to 9/11 the correct one?
No, it was not. It was way, way excessive and too focused on military force. And I'm not just talking about Afghanistan, although I think I could even critique that. Mm-hmm. I think initially Afghanistan was just about right, CIA leading the way because they were ready to go and already on the ground and had been working with the Northern Alliance for some time. But the response that expanded out of that, which was essentially a nation-building, a state-building effort, and cost tons of money, and most of that money did not go to purposes in Afghanistan. It went to U.S. contractors. Mm-hmm. And Iraq, added to that, was a disaster. I still believe that the decision to invade Iraq in 2003 will go down as the worst decision any American president has made in the entire short history of this republic.
Mm-hmm.
It was a disaster. It's still paying. It still has dividends lying out there, and the dividends are absolutely negative. Look at what's going on right now. We started what is happening in the Middle East right now. Neoconservatives like Richard Pearl and Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz, to a certain extent, Bill Kristol, will tell you that's wonderful, that this is great. We have turned loose the radical chaos, anarchy that's necessary in order to bring the Arabs and others in that region into the world of peace and prosperity.
Of course, there's a civil war and a power vacuum.
That's the craziest idea I've ever heard, and I said that at the time when people were trying to tell me that that's what was necessary to get this region up to speed, so to speak, to bring it into modernity, was to essentially cause chaos. And, oh, by the way, while we did that, we'd be taking down and dismembering and making disorganized and falling apart all of Israel's enemies, and so Israel would be that much safer. I would say to you that I believe, sincerely believe, Israel is in more danger today than she's been in since 1948.
Yeah. Well, someone said what we did there was like throwing a brick into a hornet's nest, and
yes.
I thought that was a pretty good analogy.
Great metaphor.
Yeah, yeah. But I know you're close with Secretary Powell, and do you talk with him much these days, or...?
Mostly by email. Occasionally, mm-hmm. We had an email today about, I asked him about the Eisenhower Memorial, and he asked me about the Smithsonian Museum for African American History and Culture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's mostly subjects that don't get us fighting with one another.
But I'd like you to set the record straight, because obviously when he was on the cabinet for President Bush, I had read or heard somewhere that when he walked in the room, he commanded, of course he has a commanding presence and very rational and brilliant. But my understanding is he did not leave of his own accord. And can you set the record straight on that? And
I think there are two views of that. I don't think he would affirm that for you.
Mm-hmm.
The two views are, in essence, that he was always going to leave after one term. He had made sure the president understood that. I understood that. Rich Armitage, the deputy, understood that. Mm-hmm. I think all of us at the State Department who knew him closely or intimately knew he was going to leave after one term. And in that respect, he left when he was supposed to leave. The other side of the story, however, one that even he doesn't like to own up to these days, is that he had more or less invested quite a bit in Iraq by that time, and the elections were coming up, and I think he had gotten some assurances from the president as well as from Condi, National Security Advisor, that he would be around until the elections in Iraq, and that was after the year turned.
Mm-hmm.
That was late January. And all of a sudden, he gets this peremptory note from a functionary over at the White House telling him to submit his resignation. He was furious. I recall his fury. I recall him going home and not coming back in. And Rich Armitage, for example, the Deputy Secretary of State, saying, "Is this legal? Can I be acting secretary while he's still here?" And we were all in a quandary for about 4 or 5 days trying to figure out what was going on. And he was quite angry. So in that respect, both versions of the story are accurate. You just need all the detail to understand where the accuracy lies.
Well, I'm glad you set the record straight on that. So, but now these books that came in, now Vice President Cheney publishes a book and says heads are going to explode all over the Washington or the country. And is that the proper role for a former vice president? Even his latest statements. I mean, isn't there an unwritten rule that once you're out of office, you typically do not criticize the current administration?
I think it's more a rule or a protocol, if you will, for the president than the vice president. And Cheney's always been an attack dog. I had a congressman tell me at lunch in the summer of 2003, as I recall, it was right after someone had written in the New Yorker that they didn't recognize Cheney anymore. It might have been Brent Scowcroft, if memory serves. This congressman said to me, "Dick Cheney's always been that way. I've known him ever since he was in the Congress. I've known him when he was chief of staff at the White House. I've known him for his entire political life, and he's always been that way. It's just that he had adult supervision before." And suddenly he didn't have any adult supervision. He is an attack dog, and now I think he feels the only way to rouse the extreme wing of the Republican Party, which is increasingly the only wing they can count on to vote, is to do the kinds of things that he's recently done, for example. Come out and make statements that are Churchillian in their rhetoric, accusing President Obama of making a mess in Iraq, when in fact what he's describing is what his administration did.
Hmm. Well, we have to take one more little break here, Colonel, but we can make more statements when we come back, and we'll get some wisdom from you right after these announcements. Hang on. All right, we're in the home stretch with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former right-hand person to Secretary Colin Powell, General Colin Powell. So we're quite honored to have him on the show. So where do we want to go with this, Richard? We wanted to
You want to ask a quick question about Baghdad?
About Baghdad. We've invested about close to $1 billion in that embassy, I believe, and with all the chaos over there, is that in any danger of getting overrun?
Certainly is. In fact, I have visions of Saigon and what happened in Vietnam in 1975 when we had to leave. But I think right now what I'm hearing from the White House and what I'm hearing from others who are still in government who will talk to me, we are very carefully, astutely even, trying to use the nuclear negotiations with Iran and the bilateral talks that we've established with some of the leadership to, in addition to deal with that, to deal with this new chaos, new fighting in Iraq. And what you might find when this comes out, and we may see the first vestiges of this, if you will, or the first inkling of this, in this month, as we come to the closure of the first six-month joint plan of action with regard to the nuclear negotiations, and we see that Iran and the United States are more or less on the same side in Iraq, trying to prevent the dismemberment of that state and trying to prevent the Sunnis and their new allies, the radical elements from Syria, ISIS, as it were, from taking over in Baghdad. And so you've got this strange alliance, not strange if you understand the history of it, but strange in terms of what the Bush administration did in 2003, between the United States and Iran and others in the region like Turkey, who are very concerned with the stability of Iraq and very concerned that it not be dismembered and want to keep whoever is the ruler in Iraq, and I hope it's not Maliki, in power. and to make a better situation politically so that the Sunnis will lose their desire to foment an insurgency. So you're looking at the possibility of this administration's foreign policy success with regard to Iran being aided and abetted by the fact that we have turmoil in Iraq right now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that's complex. I know it's difficult to think of us doing that kind of exquisite diplomacy and that kind of exquisite foreign policy and security policy. We've been so blunderbussed these last dozen years or mm-hmm. so. But I see the ingredients for this happening right now, being put together right now. And I see it as having a positive outcome if it can be pursued without the Congress messing it up to its ultimate result.
Well, any way you cut it, it's difficult dealing with a theocracy, especially a radical theocracy. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, yeah. It is. But I don't think it's a radical theocracy in Tehran. I think the Ayatollah represents that. Yes, push him aside for a moment. I think Rouhani and some of the bizarre as in B-A-Z-A-A-R, the mm-hmm. commercial aspect mm-hmm. of Iran, some of the more rational, some of the more sophisticated minds, see the kind of relationship, for example, that we had with Iran for 25 years, beginning with Eisenhower and going all the way up to Carter. That kind of relationship was a pretty sound relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The most stable nation in Southwest Asia right now is Iran. It is 75-80 million people, 50%+ of whom are Persian. It is a powerful country demographically, geographically, military-wise. It's the country that's the natural hegemon in the Gulf, and a rapprochement between the United States and Iran with the understanding that the Gulf needs to be peaceful would be a positive development in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, Colonel, can we talk about the future? I mean, what do you talk to your students about?
And if we made you Secretary of Defense or President for a day, maybe some recommendations or things you might implement to make major improvements. What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing I'd do is give the Congress back. I know we all hate the Congress these days, but I'd give the Congress back their constitutional war power. That is to say, I would restrict the executive from the ability to make war at its will,
mm-hmm.
because that's essentially what it does now.
Hmm.
That's the first thing that I would try to do is give the Congress back the war power. There are people in the Congress and even people in the executive branch who are trying to figure out how to do that right now and not make it look too glaring.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you really have is you have the Congress that through the War Powers Resolution essentially abdicated its constitutional responsibility for war.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's trying to figure out how to get that constitutional responsibility back, but as typical with our Congress, not have to share too much in the accountability of it all.
Mm.
See, Congress loves this
mm.
because if the president uses military force and it's successful, they can then get on the boat, scream and holler, and say they were right there.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's unsuccessful, then they can say they never condoned a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they can just scream and holler at the president. So it's a bunch of cowards on the Hill that
yeah.
did this.
Yeah.
If we could get the war power back where our founders thought it should be, said it should be, Madison was eloquent in this regard, giving the war power to the executive, he said, is tantamount to tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't do that. So that's the first thing I would do. The second thing I would do is try to get this business that I talked about earlier that Piketty highlights so well of one thing. Thousands of this country owning most of our wealth changed.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you do that,
tax it.
You don't collect a whole lot of revenue through this. You collect some, and the revenue could be put to good purposes. But what you do is you destroy this disequilibrium. I would have a massive estate tax. There'd be no inherited wealth in this country. We were that way for 150 years. By God, we need to get back to being that way.
Yeah.
You get wealthy through merit.
Yeah.
Do not pass it on to your children.
Bill Gates' father is in league with you. He didn't like the removal of the estate tax.
Oh, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, two, you would have a massively effective progressive tax. Like, my Republican colleagues look at me and they think I'm nuts when I tell them Eisenhower maintained the tax on the top 1% in this country at 94% for his entire 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's not to get revenue. You don't get a whole lot of revenue doing that. It's not to get revenue. It's to keep this disequilibrium from happening.
Yeah. And of course, so that we want a meritocracy. We want everyone to get a fair share. If you got talent, you should be able to succeed.
And here's a point Piketty brings out too that it stunned me when I looked at his graphs and such. A lot of the disequilibrium in this country, not in Europe, but in this country, is caused by a sort of twisted way of going after the meritocracy, and by that we mean that we pay the CEOs of some of these big corporations 600 times what their floor workers make.
It's
astonishing.
And
that's, if you will, a flowering of the meritocracy to the point where it now is even contributing to the disequilibrium. And it's not really meritocracy, as Piketty points out. If you look at the pay that a CEO gets and you look at what he contributes to the productive capacity of the corporation, to the quality of the corporation, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
In fact, some of them get this pay even though the corporation goes toast.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Now, to get to Richard's question, to try to wrap it up and get on a positive note, what do you tell your students these days?
That they need to take the reins and vote and work and, get in there and change things.
And get active in your community.
Absolutely.
Right.
I just tell them, hey, look, my generation has screwed your country up so badly that you're going to have a really hard time, but get in there and do it.
Maybe it's time for more women to get in the politics.
Absolutely.
So, it seems like that's working out. But anyway, we've got to wrap it up here. We're in the home stretch, right, Eric? Sorry about that, but Colonel
Wilkerson, very much appreciated.
Thank you so much for being our guest. We really, really do appreciate it, and wish you a speedy recovery on the knee.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'd like to thank Eric Rubalcava, our sound engineer, for making us sound good. We'd like to thank Craig Blanke, our con executive, and our programming genius here at KFMB, Dave Sniff. You have a great week, everybody. Next week, it's Dickie Smothers, so you're going to love that one. All right, good night. See you next week. Bye-bye now.